University of Bristol. So they have a history, right? We have a history together. Mm. And so it's not a surprise to learn then that they're attacking us again. They're trying to get these programs, social media, interfered with. They've labeled your Twitter account, your personal Twitter account, my personal Twitter account, with Iran state-affiliated media. We work for Press TV. We come and do some work for them occasionally. And so it's an absurdity, but it's clear that they are targeting us specifically as opposed to anyone who works for Press TV. So there's a clue there. They're targeting people who they think are a threat to their activities. And, you know, I'm glad of that they think we're a threat.
No, indeed. And obviously doing their best to delegitimise us. When we spoke to Ammar, we asked him if he thought the Israel lobby had played a part in my removal from the Labour Party.
Britain's Israel lobby played an extensive role in removing you, not just from the Labour Party, but I would also say from mainstream parliamentary politics. And to conceptualise that, I think it's important just to spell out, you know, in this context, what we mean by Britain's Israel lobby. I mean, it's not just some sort of mysterious group. They largely, as we know, act in the open. And by lobby, we're talking about the so-called Jewish labor movement, Labor Friends of Israel. We Believe in Israel, which is an outfit run by Luke Akers, who now sits on Labor's highest governing body, the self-proclaimed Board of Deputies of British Jews, the Jewish Leadership Council, and so many other organizations, including the Community Security Trust, the Union of Jewish Students, and other student societies. And all of those groups are pro-Israel and Zionist, and they have demonstrable links to the Israeli embassy in Britain.
We also asked him, as someone who'd worked closely with me when I was in Parliament, if it was any surprise to him that the campaign against me has continued even after I left Parliament.
It's not surprising to me at all that they continue to attack you and so many others, because Zionism is a maximalist ideology. And by that, I mean that if you give them an inch, they will take a mile. They are, to put it mildly, a hungry pack of wolves who have bottomless stomachs, and they're never satisfied with whatever meat is thrown in their direction. And that's why the appeasement strategy that Jeremy Corbyn pursued was a total failure, because he thought, and the people around him mistakenly believed, that if they apologized and if they threw their own allies like yourself under the bus, that these Zionist zealots would somehow stop their attacks. And of course, that was simply an invitation to them to continue with those attacks, which is why Jeremy Corbyn is now, ironically, in the same position in which he placed you under his leadership. He's not a Labour MP anymore. And if we're realistic, he's never going to be allowed to take back his position on the Labour benches until he's eventually out of Parliament. You know, Corbyn is a man, let's remember, who, of course, helped to reinvigorate Labour politics. He saw a huge increase in the Labour vote in the 2017 general election. He grew the party's membership levels to unprecedented scales. And this is now how he's being treated. You know, I've previously called it a forever war against Corbyn and against the people who supported him. And these fanatics are determined, basically, to ensure that being pro-Palestine is never again an acceptable position in public life.
David, what do you make of the selective nature of these attacks? I mean, they seem to be outside the charitable remit of the CST, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, they're engaged in an attempt to get a programme, this programme labelled as Iran state-affiliated media. It's got nothing at all to do with our charitable objectives, which are to do with fighting anti-Semitism on the one hand, and on the other hand, fighting extremism. There's no extremism in this programme. It's evidence-based commentary, which people might disagree with, but which, you know, is clearly nothing to do with extremism. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, the CST itself does show evidence, considerable evidence, of itself being an extremist organisation and not understanding that there is such a thing as extremism in the far reaches of the Zionist community. This organisation, Chabad, that they have been briefing with counter-terror advice because I called them extremist. I mean, that's an extraordinary position. This is an extremist organization. They should be monitoring. But instead, they're giving them counter-terror advice as if I'm some kind of terror threat to this extreme Zionist organization. That's an absurdity. And we face, you know, the potential, I think, as a result of these kinds of activities, of the CST's charitable status looking a little bit wobbly. Well, let's see how that goes.
Yes, indeed. Well, we also asked Anwar about the fact that as the CST were fully embedded in the Labour Party during the Corbyn years, giving anti-Semitism workshops, etc., when did it become apparent to Anwar that the Labour Party had been entirely captured and was working effectively as an internal surveillance system?
The Labour Party was already captured by pro-Israel interests before Corbyn was elected Labour leader in 2015. The former Labour Prime Minister Gordon Brown visited the Knesset in Tel Aviv in 2008, in which he said that Britain would always stand firmly by Israel's side. So Corbyn's election in 2015 was, in fact, a very brief, limited rupture in pro-Israel consensus in the Labour Party. But that was tamed very early on in his leadership. At the beginning of 2016, there was a manufactured scandal in the Oxford University Labour Club about supposed anti-Semitism. And Corbyn's instinct, unfortunately, was to commission Baroness Janet Royal, who had links with Labour Friends of Israel, to conduct an inquiry. And then we saw this same cowardly approach being taken in relation to his longtime ally and friend, the former Mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. And so his disposition to try to run away or to kick these issues into the long grass, of course, whilst throwing his own friends to the wolves, was pretty much set in stone at that point. And it pretty much just got worse from there. The British state truly is, you know, parliamentary interests are largely on this issue, dictated by two groups, Labour Friends of Israel and Conservative Friends of Israel, which boast hundreds of parliamentary members between them. And these groups are, of course, directly linked to the Israeli embassy. And many of the MPs that are in those groups often go on all expenses paid trips to the State of Israel, and they receive donations from them. In fact, a former Conservative minister under Theresa May, Sir Alan Duncan, wrote in his diaries, which have been published, that he had been subject, in his own words, to the most disgusting interference from pro-Israel lobbyists. And he said, and I quote, "They will interfere at a high level in British politics in the interests of Israel on the back of donor power in the UK." So really, it's no surprise that these characters in Parliament and in government would then give millions of pounds to an Israel lobbying group. And it also shows that the tail now wags the dog. You know, the Israel lobby in Britain dictates to the British government and not the other way around.
David, given everything that you've learnt about the CST, I mean, would it be fair to describe it as an extremist organisation?
I think we're now in the territory of being able to describe it that way. I think I don't think I realised quite how extreme this organisation was until really comparatively recently. Yeah. I mean, I've discovered recently the origins of the alleged anti-racist group, which led eventually to the creation of the CST, which back in the 1940s signed up en masse to the ERGUN, the revisionist Zionist terrorist organisation. And the CST comes effectively some decades later out of that milieu. And we see now the way in which they are advising extremist organisations as if they're the victims of extremism. So there's a really difficulty here, is that it appears to be a liberal anti-racist organisation, but in the end it's defending some really quite extreme activities in occupied Palestine, including, you know, actual revenge murders of Palestinians.
Indeed. Well, we're just going to pause there for a moment and have a look at this report on how Zionist groups have been colonising and attempting to capture Twitter on behalf of the Zionist entity.
Social media giants are hostile territory for the Palestinian cause. But it's not just that Zionist groups target pro-Palestinian accounts en masse for closure. In fact, some social media giants have Zionist groups embedded in their advisory system. Take the example of Twitter. In 2015, Twitter launched a safety center and listed a number of trusted partners in the US, Australia, and Europe. In the area of offensive speech, it listed the following groups concerned with anti-Semitism: the Representative Council of Jewish Institutions, Le CRIF, the International League Against Racism and Anti-Semitism, LICRA in France, Community Security Trust, the CST in the UK, and Anti-Defamation League, ADL in the US. All of these groups are strongly Zionist and follow the line of the Zionist regime in matters of anti-Semitism, which is to present it as identical to anti-Zionism. Among the extensive number of groups advising Twitter, there were no groups challenging anti-Palestinian racism. There was only one group that claimed to represent the interests of Muslims, Muslim Advocates. This is a US-based group that is full of former financial services and consulting staff and seems to have an aversion to the use of the word Islamophobia. It's funded by Mackenzie Bezos, the former wife of the Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, and by a number of liberal foundations. Its weak stance is complemented by its collaboration with progressive Zionist groups like Bend the Ark Jewish Action, whose largest donor is Alexander Soros, the son of financier, philanthropist, and regime change enthusiast George Soros. Amongst its activities, it's made allegations of anti-Semitism against the pop star Taylor Swift, which were false. From 2018, the list of groups evolved. It still included the ADL in the US, European Jewish Information Centre, the CEJI in Brussels, and the Board of Deputies of British Jews in the UK. The CEJI is a Zionist organisation and advertises that it works closely with a range of Zionist groups as partners, including B'nai B'rith in Europe, the Dutch Centre for Documentation and Information on Israel, the CST in London, the European Union of Jewish Students, LICRA in France, and others. Amongst its funders are Google, Facebook, TikTok, and Twitter itself, a significant conflict of interest. The Board of Deputies states in its 2020 annual report that it has a close working relationship with the Embassy of Israel in the UK and strengthened links to the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs and the IDF. If you want to know why Twitter is hostile to Palestinian rights, look no further than its structural relationship with hardline Zionist groups, which give them a stranglehold over the access of voices in support of the liberation of Palestine.
David, surely it can't be right, can it, for Twitter to take advice on critics of Israel exclusively from groups that are essentially just apologists for Zionist crimes?
Well, you would think so, but here we are, and this is how it works. These are, as you say, apologists for Zionist crimes, and they're advising on which people can speak on matters of Palestinian rights. It's absolutely extraordinary. If there was some kind of balance in there, if they had, I don't know, Palestine Solidarity groups, you know, checking some of this stuff and checking the extremist Zionist content on Twitter, which is a lot, then you might have a different sort of argument. I wouldn't go all the way with that, but you might have a different argument. But we don't. All we have is Zionist groups who have an effective stranglehold over what's admissible on Twitter. That's not an open platform. That's no kind of social media freedom. That is absolutely a propaganda platform.
Yeah, incredible. I mean, turning to Amor again, I mean, we asked him why there's such a lack of critical thinking about what exactly the Israel lobby is in this country.
I think that many people, especially people on the British left, regrettably, are uncomfortable coming to terms with the reality of the Israel lobby in this country, because they would have to then reevaluate what their idea of imperialism is, how imperialism works in the 21st century, and who wields power and what that looks like. And they'd also have to confront the fact that the Zionist project is an imperial one. The state of Israel is not simply a state in the conventional sense. And I don't think they want, frankly, the moral burden of confronting that reality. And I'd also say more broadly that people in general have been so taken in by the smear campaign that they either genuinely believe in it or they're, you know, paralyzed by fear of the consequences of taking a stand against this hostile foreign interference in our politics.
David, what about these Muslim advocates groups? I mean, do you think that provides any balance in the decision-making process at all?
Well, no, there's this one organisation, it's a US-based, very well-heeled organisation, as the film showed, with people from the financial services sector, from the consultancy industry, that kind of thing, and their material is weak. They do some court cases, which have a, you know, a sort of civil rights approach, but they also, you know, collaborate with the liberal Zionist organisations, which are engaged in the anti-Semitism witch hunt. I mean, that example of Taylor Swift there was a particularly egregious example. I mean, Taylor Swift had complained that Soros had been involved in releasing an album of hers without her permission, and she referred to this in relation, and she used the word greed. And they immediately said, oh, that's a trope, that's a trope about Jewish greedy people. And you're like, no, it's not. This is completely absurd. And so, you know, an advocate group for Muslims focusing on Islamophobia should have nothing to do with organisations like that. So it's really not a proper Muslim advocacy organisation, and that gives the lie to the whole project.
Sure. Yeah. Well, finally, we asked Amar what he would say to the social media companies who are placing this trust in the Israel lobby to police speech on their platforms.
Well, I think it's very dangerous, and I would say it's less about trust, and it's more about this concept of capture, as we've been discussing. You know, in many ways, the Israel lobby, in Britain at least, use the Labour Party as a sort of incubator for its tactics, which they've then exported not just to social media companies, but in universities, trade unions. And internationally, you know, the state of Israel has been working very hard as a diplomatic objective to capture social media companies to the point where now they effectively outsource their judgment on Palestine-related issues to proxies of the Israeli government.
Well, that's it for today's show. I hope you've found it informative. Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So, until next time, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we try to answer your questions, issues you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, acquire knowledge when you're very young, because when you grow up, you're going to be successful and progressful for your society. In this program, we try to give you the tips. We try to give you the information how you can make your children give all that knowledge as young as possible, where you can start up with your children. While on that note, we have with us in our studio today Mr. Salman Akavi, who is a faculty member of Al Mustafa University and an Islamic researcher in the Hafsa Almi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
It's an honor. Thank you very much.
Brother Nakavi, in our previous sessions, we talked about how we can help a child maintain relationship with his own self. In this session, I would want to ask you how a child can develop, maintain relationships with other human beings.
Yes, we are talking about the classification of behavior.
Yeah.
As you said, that we have talked about the relationship with oneself and all the various types of things which he has to take care of, she has to take care of as a child or as a parent who is trying to teach and educate their children about these things.
Yes.
So now we come to the point where we have to teach our child about how to maintain relationships.
Yes.
With other human beings.
Yeah.
So when it comes to the other human beings, the first thing which comes is the family.
Okay.
My relationship with my family. Okay. I have to teach him how to behave with his family, which his family means
the parents themselves. Yes.
How he should be able to maintain a relationship with his or her parents. That is very much the foremost thing that has to be taught. And of course, they are grandparents.
Yes.
If people have their children who have their grandparents living with them, or even if not living with them, but how to deal with their grandparents, how to love them, take care of them. How to respect them, how to maintain a good friendly relationship with them, how to take care of them. Many people have grandparents who are of age, they are sick, they are ill, and so many things. So we're just talking about the major issues that are there. Then at a detailed level, we have to go into the different details, the intricacies of these relationships. But just to give the bigger picture, that as a parent, because we're talking about our audience are the parents.
Yes.
We're talking to the parents now.
Yeah.
And the parents should know what their scope of guidance and upbringing is. So we talked about how to manage their relationships.
With self.
And now we're talking about with other human beings. And the foremost thing is the family. The relationship which a child should have with the parents themselves. The parents have to teach him or her how to deal with his or her parents.
Yes.
And that, of course, can be done by my parents are alive and my children observe how I am dealing with my parents, how I respect them, how I establish that loving relationship with them, that relationship where there's trust and there's love and there's respect. And he or she observes me taking care of my parents.
Okay.
And he or she will certainly
automatically learn that. Indeed.
Then comes the level of my siblings, my brothers and sisters. So how do I deal with my sister? How I deal with my brother?
And if they're elder to you, how do you deal with them? If they're younger than you,
so many issues are there.
Yes. So these relationship domains are important. How you manage all that is important. And how a child can develop all the skills. We'll continue that discussion with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about how a child can manage relationship with others. And the first thing we came to know about was how he can manage relationship with his family, his parents, his mother, his father, his grandparents, his siblings. And now you're talking about other relationships.
So, yes, as we said, I mean, others, the first thing, the parents themselves, the grandparents, and then the siblings. And then one is getting prepared for marriage.
Yes.
Now he has to marry. He has to know how to manage his relationship with his spouse or her spouse. That is also, it has to be taught. It has to be learnt in the family.
Okay, so so I as a parent have to manage my behavior with my partner so that my child learns how he behaves with his spouse tomorrow.
Exactly. Of course, there are certain things which I cannot teach them. I should send my child to
a mentor.
Pre-marital course or something like that where he learns or she learns how to engage. I mean,
how to behave tomorrow.
I mean, unfortunately, in the beginning, there's all love, 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 and then there's quarrel, quarrel, quarrel.
Yes, yes, of course.
So how do we do that?
Because they don't have a proper knowledge about how to deal with all these relationships.
There's a slogan given one of our Iranian scholars in Persian. He says, "Aqilane izdivaj konid."
Okay, what does that mean?
It means that when you are going to get engaged and going to get married, make a proper intellectual decision.
Yeah.
Understand each other. Understand what your goals
get
are.
Get involved intellectually goals. How, and then
are you compatible?
That.
Are you compatible?
Yeah.
Before putting on this,
yes,
it's like a chain.
Yeah.
It's not going to be removed easily. So before you put on that chain,
just know that intellectually,
what
kind of chain you're putting on.
And then live with a loving relationship.
Yeah.
But mostly we do it oppositely.
We start with love and then we try to go to the intellect. All right. So that's
so
an important
this
point.
Is how I, so my, I have to learn how to, for example, when I'm getting married, I know how to select my spouse.
Okay.
How to, that selection is done. And then after getting married, how we have to live together. What are the rules,
the fiqh
rules, the ethics.
Yeah.
And how to manage these relationships.
Yes.
So I have to learn that.
All right.
Mostly we start learning after
getting into a relationship.
Of course, much of that, it's natural that much of that learning comes afterwards, but you have to be prepared for that.
Yes, yes.
At least on a theoretical level.
Definitely.
And then comes our relationship with our children. I have to be able to, when my child is going to become a parent, then how to manage his or her relationship with their children.
Well, that's a turn over here. So what other relations a child has to learn? I'll talk on that note with you after a short break, dear listeners. Stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
The Prophet ﷺ said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about how a child can manage relationship with others. Mr. Naqvi, so far you said how he can manage relationship with his parents. He needs to take care of his relationship with grandparents. He needs to take care of his relationship with siblings, be that younger, be that elder. He needs to take care of their relationship with a spouse when he gets elder, when he gets grown up tomorrow. And when he becomes a parent tomorrow, how he develops a relationship with his own children. That all has to be learned from a particular age.
And that's, we were talking about the family relationship, and
yes,
we were talking about the first degree relatives. These are the first degree relatives. And then we have the second degree relatives.
Of course.
A whole big family. Many people have big families, huge families, aunts and uncles and cousins and so many.
Joint families, extended families.
So many things which have, we have so many relationships we have to manage.
Yes.
And then we have amongst those second-degree relatives, as I said, the blood relatives.
Yes.
And more important than when you get married, you have in-laws.
Of course.
So that's the most delicate relationship, which is, you know, which has to be maintained.
Yes. So if you're prepared at a very early age for all that, all those relationships, and when you reach that particular age of marriage, and then when you have in-laws, you don't get into trouble.
Exactly. I mean, the basic values which govern our relationships, basically the general principles are the same for every relationship. I'm not trying to say and impress upon the audience that there are so many relationships and so many difficulties. Yes, these are challenges, but certain core values, knowledge, skills are there, which are general for all.
Okay.
But then there are certain knowledge and skills which are specific for certain relationships.
Okay.
I mean, certainly the relationship which you have with your parents or your siblings is quite different from what is there with your spouse.
Okay.
So the skill, knowledge and skill set differs quite
There's a huge difference between those maintenance of relationships.
Yes.
With your siblings and your spouse and others.
Of course, and your children, and then your blood relatives, then your in-laws. So these are very delicate issues which have to be managed. And one has to be able to, one should be prepared. I mean, what are we targeting? We are targeting general competencies in human behavior.
Yeah.
We're not talking about professional competencies. We're not talking about that. It's just one aspect of our lives.
Okay.
Professional competencies, I'm becoming a doctor, I'm becoming an engineer, I'm becoming a software specialist, I'm becoming a manager.
Yeah. Well, so these were all general relationships one has to take care of, one has to learn at a very early age. And as soon as a child learns all that, he gets into developed into what we want. And maybe when he is, he's professional at this general level, he gets professional at a social level as well tomorrow. Thank you so much, Mr. Nakavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us, you have any feedback, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on the social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also download our programs on our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanullah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returns upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
اون چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa Allah. Allahu ya Allah wallahu akbar.
Whatever pertains to the order of Allah is to be respected. You kiss the cover of the word of Allah and touch your eyes to it. Well, it is a cover. Why? Because within this cover lies the words of Allah. Everything is for Allah. To whomever we accord respect, it must be for the sake of Allah. Our nation, which a few days ago would kiss this pickaxe, did so with the motive that clergyman was the deputy of their prophet. They themselves would cry out, O deputy of our prophet.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Shiism. In one of his speeches, he refers to an important point about the Shia school of thought, and he says that one of the intrinsic features of Shiism from the beginning up to now is resistance and uprising against oppression and dictatorship, which has been clearly evident throughout the history of Shiism, although such struggles have climaxed at crosscurrents of time. In this part of speech, he is referring to a very important point, and this can be seen in the history, that the Shia school of thought was the only school of thought which can claim that it has always uprised against the oppression. It has always shown the resistance against the oppression and the dictatorship. We can see clearly at the time of Imam Ali alayhi salam, when from the Banu Umayyah, Muawiyah ibn Sufyan became the dictator Imam raised against him. We can see that at the time of Imam Hassan, Imam Hassan raised against him. At the time of Imam Hussein, when Yazid ibn Muawiyah has shown the dictatorship, he performed the oppression. Obviously, Imam Hussein stood against that oppression. He raised his voice against it. Why? Because Islam is against the dictatorship. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the guardian of everyone. Allah is the main ruler. He will assign the prophet. He will assign the infallible imams for our guidance. Therefore, the oppression that we see, the dictatorship that we see in today's world, even in today's world, we see that it is the Shia school of thought that is raising its voice against all this dictatorship and oppression.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala.
When we see oppression in the Palestine, it is the Shia school of thought, it is Imam Khomeini, who named the last Friday of the month of Ramadan as the Yawm al-Quds, Day of Quds, which is a protest against the oppression of the Zionist regime. It is Imam Khomeini who raised his voice. It is the Shia school of thought in which the voice was raised against the dictatorship, where the Shah's dictatorship was changed to a republic, Islamic Republic of Iran. Therefore, we see that throughout the history, even before that, even before Imam Khomeini, there were many other resistance. We can see that they all were against the oppression. They all have raised their voice against the oppression. This is what we see in the Shia school of thought. And this is only the Shia school of thought that can claim that always and always it was the Shia school of thought that has made resistance and raised against the oppression and dictatorship.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Insight.
Good afternoon and welcome to Insight. On this episode, we will be discussing China-Iran relations in a conversation with Ambassador Chang Hua. But first, let's take a look at this brief analysis.
In March of 2021, Iran and China signed the 25-year strategic agreement following a process which began with Chinese President Xi Jinping's state visit to Iran in 2016 and his meeting with the leader of the Islamic Revolution. A strategic alliance of the two ancient civilizations of East and West Asia, who were dominated by foreign imperial powers in the 19th century and who were able to liberate themselves in the mid and late 20th century in two massive popular revolutions. Beyond the bilateral dimensions, this strategic agreement sent shockwaves throughout Western capitals, who had been dreaming of bringing Iran back into the Western strategic sphere of influence after the Islamic Revolution, through an imposed war in the 1980s, and through political destabilization campaigns, immoral economic wars, and full-spectrum maximum pressure sanctions, which were recently determined to be illegal under international law by the United Nations Special Rapporteur, who was tasked to investigate their legality and impact on human rights. Future historians might look at the history of the 20th century and conclude that besides the two world wars that shook the world, the two revolutions of China and Iran, which liberated these ancient lands, reawakened these ancient pillars of human civilization, and established the People's Republic and the Islamic Republic, respectively, are among the most significant events of the 20th century, with a very significant impact on global affairs in the 21st century and beyond. The rise of Asia, Eurasian integration, and the strategic alignment of China, Iran, and Russia spell the eventual end of US global hegemony and the beginning of the post-American world. The whole world is already benefiting from the moral wisdom of these two ancient civilizations' increased presence and prominence in global affairs, foreshadowing a future global system stressing mutual cooperation and peace over the crude, racist, imperialistic mindset of historically, relatively, and recently civilized tribes from a small peninsula on the western end of Asia, which were able to dominate global affairs for a few centuries through mass murder, slavery, and theft of resources on a global scale.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. Thank you for joining us on Insight. Also, thank you for hosting us. We are at your residence in the garden, in this lovely garden. I hope that we can have a lovely conversation about various subjects. With your permission, I would like to start our conversation speaking about the recently concluded, successfully hosted and concluded 14th BRICS Summit. That was hosted by China, which also included the BRICS Plus format, where China invited the president of Iran to speak there, and he had a good speech there within that forum. So the first question I have for you is if you could please give your evaluation, your analysis of the BRICS Summit and the BRICS Plus, particularly as it relates to the presence of President Raisi, the Iranian president, at that forum.
First, I would like to thank you for having me today and a welcome to my residence. Here we have a really nice Persian garden.
As you know, this year China is the rotating chair of BRICS countries. And this year we are organizing more than 200 events in China for this BRICS organization. Most important ones include the 14th BRICS Summit that was held on June 23rd and high-level negotiations on global developments that was held on June 24th. Actually, both these meetings have the same subject and the same theme, which is security and development. In the 14th BRICS Summit, the presidents of the countries exchanged views about developments in various areas and many other issues, which were their concerns. They talked about a lot of international and regional issues as well. They emphasized that all developing countries should stay together and united and work for development. One important thing was that after the summit, we issued the Beijing Declaration. I would like to stress that in the Beijing Declaration, there is a paragraph which focuses on Iranian nuclear issues. All BRICS leaders call on the international community to resolve Iran's nuclear issues and adjust to it through diplomatic and political ways. President Xi Jinping, during his speech in the BRICS summit, he actually put forward the importance of a new initiative. It's fair to say that we are giving new momentum to the BRICS organization, to the development of this organization, and we started a new journey for BRICS. Regarding the high-level dialogues on global development, and that is the BRICS Plus meeting, we invited 13 leaders from different countries to join this meeting, including President Raisi, the President of the Islamic Republic of Iran. In Chinese government, there is this belief that we should expand the sphere of the BRICS Plus, because BRICS Plus should be an open platform. We encourage the new emerging markets and the developing countries to join us so that we could talk about and discuss issues such as peace, security, and development issues. So we invited countries from different areas and countries. That is a very good opportunity for these regions. Iran is a very important country in the Middle East, and it is also a very important developing country. China has good relations with Iran. We're actually comprehensive strategic powers. In the recent years, our mutual political choice is to get a stronger and have deeper cooperation in different areas. So I think the presence of President Raisi in the BRICS Plus meeting was significant. We wanted to invite him to join us and talk about more issues regarding development and also our unity in various areas. Such events benefit both countries in the field of economic development and preservation of multilateralism.
Very interesting, Mr. Ambassador. We're going to get to the issue of China-Iran relations, inshallah, in the course of our conversation. I want to stay with one aspect that you mentioned, which I think was important, which you need to talk about, which is you mentioned the concept of security in the context of BRICS. BRICS initially was more of a organization that was and still is focused on development, on economics, but we see, because of the events that have happened in the world in the last years, particularly the behavior that we see from some of the Western countries, America, so on and so forth, we see that the issue of security has become more important and has entered those fora which it maybe was not in before, such as BRICS. A similar issue is so. With that in mind, I want to ask you about the Global Security Initiative that was discussed by President Xi in the annual Asia conference. And as you know, of course, there was we could almost say there was almost blackout, a media blackout of this issue in the Western media, in the mainstream media, because they don't report the things that they don't like to hear. And yet it was a very important initiative. It was something that the majority of the nations, the Asian nations and the nations that were there, were positive towards. So if you could please explain for our audience who are not familiar with this initiative, first of all, what it is and how you see, again, the role that Iran plays in this and the role that it can have in this global security initiative that was proposed by President Xi.
I should say that the world we are seeing now is full of disorders and insecurity. We have some security issues which are traditional and some other security issues which are new. There are still wars in this world, and unfortunately, terrorism is spreading throughout the world. On the other side, there are some security issues which are new, such as the issues of climate change and also COVID-19 pandemic. So what kind of security are we seeking is the main question in the face of the human being today. What concept of security? This year, President Xi Jinping, during a speech in the annual conference of our Forum for Asia, mentioned the Global Security Initiative, which I believe is the main answer to the security questions and problems that we are facing today. So this global security issue has many connotations, actually, but the main and most important one is that we should abide by international law and UN chapter at its core. We need to focus on the issue of security and development at the same time. We should both think of the traditional and non-traditional issues. That's how we can support each other. This way we can address and solve hostile issues through peaceful negotiations and through political diplomatic ways. I mean, all these initiatives have one simple principle which is aimed at promoting global security. That is the most important part of our responsibility. There is a Chinese saying which says peace and harmony are two most important things in this world. The two words are the most precious parts of Chinese traditional culture. So by putting forward this global security initiative combined with global development initiative that was put forward by President Xi last year, we can build a society which shares a future for the humankind. President Raisi, also in his speech during the high-level negotiations on global development, expressed his support for this global security initiative and the global development initiative. I think this fully demonstrates that China and Iran have similar positions and stances about such issues, about seeking peace and development in this world. So we are both very important countries in Asia. So we call on this international community and we call on Middle Eastern countries to address their hostile issues via negotiations and peaceful dialogues. We can also collaborate more to promote security and peace in this region. I think the most important thing is that we let the people of the Middle East to solve their own problems. China and Iran can totally have better coordination and collaborations about such issues.
Well, it's interesting, Mr. Ambassador. I think I understand now why they don't want to report this initiative, because it's clear now that the concept that what the Chinese leadership is proposing, what we in Iran have been talking about for many decades, is that the very concept of security is a much more broader concept. It's not this simply about the issues relating to military or to security issues, food security, you know, health. And of course, we saw in the pandemic, you know, all the masks fell. Everybody realized who is you know, going to help who is selfish, who is not going to help, who is saying certain things but acting in a different way. So I think this is very significant that you explained this for us. The whole concept of security is changing. And maybe, again, Mr. Ambassador, maybe when you have two ancient cultures and two ancient civilizations who are a little bit more mature and experienced, they understand that security is not a simple thing. There's a lot of aspects to it. Maybe those countries who are younger and newer and maybe, you know, don't have that civilizational experience. And of course, they themselves are facing a major crisis now. They themselves have reached a dead end with their own security definitions that are just purely based on power and trying to control everybody, even their own friends, even their own allies. So I think this was very interesting that you mentioned this, that it's more than just a political thing that Iran and China are trying to do. It's a whole new vision of what global security can be. And of course, it comes with the idea of trying to get to a world where there is, as you said, harmony and peace. Of course, we would add from an Iranian Islamic perspective that justice always has to be done. This is unfortunately one of the things that we see very much lacking. And I think everybody has now seen by the behavior, China, Russia, Iran, that we need to have a little bit more justice than it was in the previous. I want to, before we get to the Iran-China relations, which we have a lot to discuss in that area, I want to stay a little bit with these more historic, strategic, deeper subjects. As you know, our program aims to be a little bit more of a deeper conversation, not so much, Yes. So what I want to talk about, Mr. Ambassador, is, you know, maybe if historians in 100 years and 200 years are going to look back at our time, they're not going to be talking so much about the American Revolution or the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution. Maybe they're going to be talking about the Chinese and the Iranian Revolution as those very significant, historically important revolutions in the 20th century. We have, again, these two ancient Asian civilizations, one in West Asia, one in East Asia, reawakening in the 20th century. Of course, the Chinese Revolution is 1949, and the Iranian Revolution, 1979. So within a 30-year time, we have these two ancient cultures, civilizations rising up again. And contrary to the revolutions that I mentioned, these are actually genuine popular people's revolutions. They are revolutions that have fundamentally transformed these two countries. In the case of Iran, you see that the revolution brought out tens of millions of people out of extreme poverty, illiteracy, ignorance, and in the case of China, hundreds of millions of people, because, of course, you know, the relative population size of China. So I think for the younger generation and for those viewers who are not familiar, because these things are not covered a lot for them in the Western media, if you could please, as somebody who's lived through these changes, as somebody who's seen these transformations, explain to us a little bit for our audience, you know, what was the essence of these major transformation that has happened in China from where it was in your own lifetime? I remember when I was born in 1972, Iran had 30% literacy. There was only 30% of the people were literate. Today we see, you know, almost 100% literacy, and, you know, women being in education and being working. So if you could explain for our audience what this historic transformation has been since the revolution that happened in 1949.
I would like to say a few sentences about security issues first. I should say that during the long history of humankind, actually the times that we have experienced peace and stability are very uncommon. We witnessed a lot of wars and instabilities throughout history. The First World War and the Second World War caused a lot of damage and cost to the humankind. At the time being, unfortunately, some Western countries are trying to build a small circle of power. They try to press and suppress other countries, and they try to use their currencies and other economic tools to sanction other countries. If they only focus on their own security, they're doomed to fail. They will lose their security, and at the end of the day, they will just lose. What I am trying to say is that all people around the world should be committed to global security. All of us should be committed to that. It is a common goal, and we should all fight for that. We should be devoted to this concept. We need to try to build a security full of justice and peace. As you said, China and Iran, both of us are great countries with long histories and great civilizations. We made a lot of contributions to the world and human civilizations. The Chinese history and Iranian history, there are some similarities between us. After the 19th century, we became poor countries and we actually fell behind the global growth. Our countries were torn apart by the world superpowers of the time. Our people were living in poverty, so we all decided, our people decided, that we need a revolution. I think the political system of each nation should be decided by its own people. So in the year of 1949, we established the People's Republic of China that is 73 years old today. During these years, our path and journey has been a rare one. It was not an ordinary one. 73 years ago, Chinese people stood up. We gained the liberation of our nation. We drove out the foreign invaders. We decided that the communist part of China should be our leader. And we chose the socialist system as our core system of government. And after that, we switched focus on economic development and tried hard to build that. In the year 1979, we started a phase of reforms and opening up. I was born in 1966, and a lot of people of my generation were not able to watch TV. We were not able to watch sports events until the year of 1974. The first time that we saw a sports event on TV was actually about the Asian Games that were held in Iran, Tehran in 1974. A lot of Chinese people were quite surprised because Iran back then was a country with prosperity and it was a rich country. I remember that I saw on the TV screen that on the streets of Iran at the time there were a lot of cars and vehicles. But at the same time in China, we didn't have that many vehicles back then.